lack thereof, of Commissioner Tom Sorrell. That was kind of close. Come on. Okay. All right. And then after that, on the agenda, folks, we have an overview, and that's number three on the agenda. After the confirmation proceedings, you know, if that goes okay, then we'll have the commissioner and Assistant Commissioner Connie Sahibjim come and give us a brief overview on the department's business, and then we'll get into primary seatbelt legislation. So with that, Commissioner, welcome to the committee. And, you know, we've had a little less than a year of having you at the helm over in the department. And, you know, a lot of us have seen some changes that are that really have enhanced the activity that MnDOT provides for the public. And a lot of us are very happy that some of those changes have been made. Talking with the staff and even the person, you know, that plows the snow out in front of my house, they all seem to be pretty happy. So I think you're doing a pretty pretty doggone good job. But, you know, I got this article here in front of me, and, you know, gosh darn. You know, they list people who are the top 10 political persons in 2008. I just want to know how come that you're 10 and not like 2 or 3. So, but anyway, with that, Commissioner, if you want to give any opening remarks, and then we're going to open it up into some questions, and I have some as well.
Sure. Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, members. And I told the folks back in the office, if I'm back there early, this didn't go so well. So, but I do thank you for the opportunity to come in front of you today. And what I hope to do is share a little bit about the strategic vision of MnDOT and where we're potentially headed, and share with you some of the things that we have been doing in recent months. I think they're very good things, and I'd like to share those with you. And also share a little bit about my background. I know in the package that we handed out, you have my resume, and there's a lot of stuff in there, but I would like to just take the opportunity to highlight a few things in there that were pretty significant to me anyhow. So that's how I'm going to proceed ahead here. I do want to say when I start is people ask me when I took this position why I would want to do this, and it was a good question, but I put a lot of thought into it. You know, you look around this country, and we're in a very transitional time right now for transportation in our country. We have federal reauthorization in front of us. We have a federal trust fund that's been broke and is in trouble, and it's sustainable for another year or so, but then something else has to happen. We had the federal government not pay their bills for a few days this past year. And so there's a lot of interesting challenges in our country related to transportation. And at the state level, we're all facing issues. You look at what other states are doing and the challenges we face. Our vehicle miles of travels are down. Our gas prices are up. It's impacting the income coming into all the state DOTs. So all the state DOTs are having to make adjustments. So it's a very transitional time, and it's a very challenging time. And that's why I assumed this position. I was very excited about that. I viewed these challenges as opportunities, and that's truly how I looked at it. And I wanted to be part of the solution. I think we all know as well that when the I-35W bridge collapsed, our world changed. Our world changed in transportation, and we had different kinds of expectations out there, and we have to address those expectations. And I wanted to be part of that. I wanted to be in a leadership role where I could be an active leader and bringing the community back and being a viable and sustainable transportation community for our citizens. When I came into this job, there are basically four objectives that I had, and these are objectives that I laid out to the governor when he interviewed me, and I want to share those with you here today. First and foremost, I wanted to be, as commissioner, an advocate for MnDOT. MnDOT employees, MnDOT programs, and MnDOT projects. And I thought that was a very important role that I needed to serve as commissioner, because if I can be an advocate for MnDOT, it opens up doors for our employees. It opens up doors to work in a collaborative environment. and opens up the doors to work as partners within our community. So I think that's a very important role that I serve. The second objective that I have as commissioner is to really work really hard to sustain public trust in MnDOT and in transportation and in our community. Again, our world changed when that bridge collapsed and public trust was somewhat diminished. And we've got to work really hard to sustain public trust in all that we do. The third objective that I have in this position is to really be a strong leader in transportation, not only at the state level, and be a leader for all the transportation partners in our state, whether it be counties or cities, whether it be the consultants or the contractors. That's a role I think that the commissioner needs to serve. And the commissioner needs to serve in that role at a national level as well, because if you're able to do that, then you can really sustain innovation and creativity in the department and in our community. So that's an important role I think the commissioner serves. And lastly, an objective that I have as commissioner is really try to fulfill our responsibilities for transparency and accountability. And I know transparency is a word that's used very often these days, but it's a word and it's a philosophy that fits very, very well into the kinds of work we do, the public works work that we do. And so it's important for us to be transparent and accountable in all that we do. As far as my background, you have my resume. I don't want to walk through that resume. That would take a while, but just want to highlight a few things about my career. When I first started in transportation, I started with the Federal Highway Administration some 30 years ago. And my goal when I started my career was to touch every element of program and project delivery as I came up through the organization, and that's what I tried to do. One of my first jobs in the organization, I was out in Texas. I worked on a project in Dallas. I was a project inspector. I was out there inspecting work. I was in a plant. I was in an asphalt plant, a concrete plant, doing mixed designs and things like that. I did a stint on a survey crew, and I think that was very important for me, and it's something that I think helps me very well in where I'm at today. I then shifted gears, and I wanted to touch the planning arena. I went to work in Arizona. I worked for the Tucson MPO, and I helped develop the long-range plan for the Tucson MPO. So I wanted to touch every element and facet of our industry. I then did various stints as a safety engineer, a research engineer, and various other capacities as well. Then I moved into management positions, and I did a little stint supervising a team of technical specialists in New York, ITS, pavement material safety, and other technical specialties. These were pure technical specialists. I did a stint as a director of planning and program development in the northeastern states, getting involved with planning and environment activities. And some of the jobs that I think were very helpful to my background that I really enjoyed, I ended up in Utah for a period of time working on the 2002 Winter Olympic Games. And I had a very unique job. I was the USDOT Olympic liaison there. And while I was there, I represented all the modal administrations, FAA, FTA, NHTSA, FRA. And it was my job to work with the community, to work with the Olympic planners, and help build out the appropriate infrastructure for the games. And it was a very unique job. We had LRT going into the Salt Lake City area at that time. We had the first big, large mega project, design-build project, I-15. Very dynamic environment to work in, and certainly I learned a lot there. Then I moved to Washington, D.C., and my career took a little change, and I was director of a policy analysis group. I supervised a group of economists, and we were responsible for tracking the trust fund and the viability of the trust fund. And I worked a lot with folks on the Hill and staffers on the Hill, and did a lot of policy analysis kind of work. I moved into the mega project arena, and I led a mega project team for Federal Highway, and we worked on projects such as the Big Dig and T-Rex in Denver. And I had federal responsibilities for those projects as a team leader in that area. Then I landed here in Minnesota, and I was the division administrator for the Federal Highway Administration and responsible for the administration of the federal aid program here. And it varies here in Minnesota, $400 million to $600 million, depending upon the year. But that's my general background. And again, one of my goals in my career was to touch every element of transportation, every element of program and project delivery, And personally, it serves me very well. It serves me very well today, and I think it's very helpful in this position as commissioner. As far as my education, I do have a civil engineering degree from the University of Buffalo. I have an MBA from Thomas College in Maine. I have a certificate in project management from George Washington University. I have a certificate in conflict management from the Cornell School of Industrial and Labor Relations. I also have additional training. I attended the Federal Executive Institute in Virginia. It's an in-house training program, a four-week in-house training program. It's kind of like the Kennedy School for Federal Executives. I also attended the Wharton Transportation Executive Program, which has a focus on finance. So that's my background, and again, there's more information on my resume, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about that. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the strategic vision and direction that we're pursuing at MnDOT. And if you could pull out a few handouts out of your package, there's a little brochure on strategic vision that I want to reference. And then there's this multicolored paper on your destination, our priority. And then there's a handout on transparency that I want to mention a few things about. But if you can start with the strategic vision brochure, that's this brochure right here. I want to talk a little bit about what's in here because this kind of defines our strategic vision for the department. If you look at this brochure, I want to tell you how we developed this and a little bit of the history. When I came into the department, we had a similar brochure called the Strategic Plan. It was dated 2003. I took a look at that and thought it clearly needed an update and some refreshing, if you will. And what I did is, acknowledging that we have some folks in our department that are the future of the department, they represent the future of the agency, and we need to retain those kinds of folks. We have folks in a SEEDS program. These are folks that they're in school or they're attending classes, and we hire them at MnDOT, and we try to retain them at MnDOT. I asked people in the SEEDS program to take a look at that old strategic plan and give me their vision about what the future should look like, accepting the fact that they are our future, and their vision is just as important as anything. So they pulled this brochure together in a matter of a week. I assigned a couple of key advisors to them, some leadership folks in the department. But it was an amazing accomplishment that they took this, they created a broad vision for the department, but yet a focused vision. And it's based on input that they've heard me talk about, that they've heard other folks talk about. And it was an amazing accomplishment. And if you look at the bottom of the front page, you see a tagline called Your Destination, Our Priority. We kicked around various taglines like this, and we came up with the usual things, Moving Minnesota, this and that, things that other people have used. And these students came up with that. And we really like that, and we've embraced that because that really encompasses a lot of things and what we're all about. So you're going to be seeing us use that. If you can open up the brochure, you'll see there's a vision in there, typical things, a mission, critical issues and responses, and our core values. What I'd like to focus on is the right part of that on the brochure called our strategic directions. These are our strategic directions that we're using to essentially build everything that we do. Safety, mobility, innovation, leadership, and transparency. Safety, we've got to continue to push our safety numbers down as low as we can, and we've got to keep that in the forefront of our minds at all times. Public safety is our number one priority, and we've got to remember that. Mobility, make sure we have people that have access to services they need, have the ability to move in ways they need to move. And I think there's one element in there that I think is pretty important. It talks about improving the quality of life for people. And I think that's a little, it's a dynamic and a shift that we're trying to acknowledge, that we're here not only to measure very traditional things like our pavements, our bridges, but we're also here to be responsive for quality of life issues. And transportation plays a key role in that. Innovation. We need to have a culture of innovation, because if we don't, we won't move ahead and move forward in many, many areas, and we need to have that culture. Leadership. This is something I take very seriously, that we need to play a strong leadership role, not only at MnDOT, but within our community. We need to be leaders in the transportation community. And I want to make an additional comment about leadership. You know, sitting behind me are the key leaders in our organization. These are folks on my commissioner staff. These are positional leaders in our organization, and they play a key role. But everybody in our department is a leader, and that's something we're trying to emphasize. Everybody is a leader. Leadership is everybody's business, and everybody in our department is an ambassador for MnDOT. And we're trying to make sure they have the freedom to do that, the freedom to be a sound ambassador for MnDOT, and to really hone their own leadership skills. And transparency, I've already mentioned that, build public trust in MnDOT. There is a paper, a white paper that's in your package that addresses transparency. When I came to the department and started talking about transparency, people would ask me, what do you mean by that? So we tried to define it, and that's what that white paper is that you have in your package. I want to say a little bit about transparency and the importance of developing trust. We recently had a manager's meeting at MnDOT, and we focused the theme of our manager's meeting on developing trust. And we got a hold of a recent book by Stephen Covey called The Speed of Trust, and we use that as a framework to have our discussions. And you read that book, and it talks about four cores of credibility in building trust: integrity, intent, competence, and results. And we're using that as a guiding principle for us in the department to build trust. Integrity. We need to be perceived as an organization of integrity. As individuals, we need to be perceived that way. If we're not, we've got a problem. Intent. We need to be perceived by the public as having their interests at heart, as individuals and as an organization. And if we're not, we've got to fix it. Competence. We need to be recognized as a competent organization. And if we're not, again, we need to fix it. And results. We need to follow through on our commitments. We need to respect public values and follow through on our commitments. And that's an important piece that we always have to remember. And if we don't, we need to fix it. So it's those cores of credibility that are very essential and key to us in building trust. And we're going to be framing a lot of our organizational development work around those. I'd like to shift now into some of the progress we have been making in particular areas. And again, they're going to be focused on those strategic directions that I mentioned. And I'm going to start in the safety area. Just mention and highlight a few things that we've been working on. I think we were here back in December. State Bridge Engineer Dan Dorgan talked a lot about what we're doing in the bridge area and our bridge program. I don't want to repeat that, but I will say we've made a lot of progress in our bridge program, and I feel very, very good about that. We've been installing cable medium barriers along critical stretches of the interstate, and if you look at the data from the installation of those medium barriers, it's very telling that they can save lives over and over and over, and we're going to really pick up the pace on that and install more of those medium barriers across the state. We've been trying to address 2-4 lane safety enhancements throughout the state. We realize and recognize there are safety issues with these 2-4 lane transitions, and we're trying to take a very proactive role in addressing those. One thing I'm very pleased about is our Towards Zero Death Initiative. Our fatality rate is the lowest that it's been since World War II, and we're going to address that a little bit more in the overview. But it's because of this Towards Zero Death Initiative and the integration of the 4 E's, emergency services, enforcement, engineering, and education. And it's something that I'm very proud of, and I think it's recognized nationally as a very unique approach. And the last thing I want to mention from a safety perspective is we're working very diligently to implement our Allied Radio Matrix for Emergency Response System. This is the system that is credited to being a true success story during the 35W bridge collapse. And many people will say if it wasn't for this system, we wouldn't have been able to respond to the collapse as well as we did. And this is a system that we're trying to implement across the state, and we hope it's done by 2013. From a mobility perspective, we've got lots going on. We've got many things that you have all seen. I want to highlight one thing in particular. We've been very active in the rail component of our mobility equation, and that's something, again, I'm very excited about. We're looking at our freight and passenger rail needs. We're in the midst of developing a rail plan. And we invited many of our rail stakeholders in to help us develop a scope of work for that rail plan. When we were doing that, it became very evident that we have a lot of diverse interests in rail across our state. And so I established a rail forum, and I invited our rail stakeholders to come in and start to discuss ways we can better collaborate and pull these interests together. And that's something, we had our first meeting before the holidays. We have another one here in a week or so. And that's something I'm very, very excited about, because there's no doubt that rail plays an important role in our transportation system and our network, and we've just got to get a handle on what the needs are out there and how to pull these together. Innovation. Minnesota has a strong reputation for innovation. We've a lot of activity in the MinPass area. You've seen activity in our Urban Partnership Agreement, 35W, where we're using dynamic shoulders and all kinds of activities there. Living snow fences is something I wanted to highlight, because I don't think a lot of people realize all of our activity there. We work on establishing snow fences in our rural highway system. We have a very strong collaborative effort with the farming community. And that's a very important role, is to build these living snow fences out there. And it has a very strong safety implications to doing so. So we're very active in that area. And another area of innovation that I'm very excited about is our pavement area, our pavement materials area. We're very active in looking at various pavement technologies, warm asphalt, the use of tear-off shingles and recycled asphalt, quiet pavements, pervious pavements, and working with the concrete industry and getting the appropriate concrete overlays out there. One thing I'm excited at we're looking at an alternative bid kind of approach to our pavement selection process. And we have run into some issues where the prices vacillate so much, it's hard to determine what the proper approach is at any given time. So we're trying to take this approach of using an alternate bid concept, where we put options out there, and then we do a life cycle cost analysis. The contractor will bid on a particular option. We'll do a life cycle analysis, a 50-year analysis, and then it backs into what the appropriate solution is. But it's an attempt to not have MnDOT dictate the solution, but to have the market drive the solution and what the market conditions are at that time. So it's a recognition that that's the world we're in today with the vacillation of prices. In terms of leadership, we've got lots going on there as well. Many of you have seen the activity we've been advancing under our statewide plan. We've done a lot of outreach in that area and gotten a lot of feedback. Something that I'm starting is the development of a high-performing partnership. I want to bring all the communities in, or all the members of our transportation communities, and try to develop a shared vision for us as a community. And I know that sounds idealistic, but I think we can do it. I think we have the public agencies, the MnDOT, the counties, the cities. I think we can work together with our private sector agent, our private sector partners, the contractors, and the consultants, and develop a shared transportation vision for our state. And I think that can be pretty powerful. I want to mention activity from a leadership perspective in the DBE area, because I think that's pretty significant, and it's a significant change for us. We've been pretty active in trying to shift our DBE approach from one of enforcement to one of being proactive and working in the community. And we had a very high goal, DBE participation goal on 35W. We achieved it and we exceeded it. And we did it by being proactive, by working with the contractors, by working with the DBE community. And I think that's a model on how we can move forward. And I'm looking forward to doing that. We've established a DBE forum, invited stakeholders to come in and help us do that. I'm considering the idea of establishing community liaisons in communities where we need that input, where we need to get make those inroads. There's a lot of things we're doing in that area that I think we're demonstrating leadership, and I think is really going to pay off for us in the end. From a transparency perspective, we have an initiative called Hear Every Voice. That's we're doing a lot of training in that area and trying to make sure that we work in a way that we include and involve the public. We created an ombudsman position in the department, and I'm going to explain more about that in the overview, but it was an attempt to bring more transparency to the department. And also, it's an attempt to bring different kinds of approaches to manage conflict into the department. I've long believed that ADR has a role in the department, and the ombudsman position can serve in that capacity to try to bring ADR techniques into transportation. Chapter 152, again, I will say that we're working very diligently on trying to implement Chapter 152, and I know we've had various discussions with several of you about that. One thing I want to point out about Chapter 152 that I think is pretty significant, we have taken the major bridges in Chapter 152, and we established a CRAVE process. This is a process in which we do risk assessments and value engineering at the same time. And in the past, in our industry, you would do a risk assessment separately, and then you'd value engineer separately and at different times. We have chosen to try this new process where we integrate both of them, and in the end, we're making sure we have the right project out there. So we're running our major bridges from Chapter 152 through this process, and it's been pretty successful to date. And this is a model that's really not a lot of states have done this. I think Washington State has done a little bit of it, but nationally we'll certainly be a leader in this area. Let me just close by highlighting couple other things. The economic stimulus package, I just want to reassure everybody that we're moving forward in that direction. We don't know what it's going to look like. It's a moving target. There's a lot of guidelines that are out there. But I just want to assure you, we are keeping in touch with that. We're very active at the national level with our national organizations and trying to keep on top of that. We established, and this is a pretty significant thing, we established an actual program manager for economic stimulus in the department and Chapter 152 projects. John Chigalow is that person. John was our project manager on the 35W bridge. John has pulled together a lot of information to help us streamline processes and deliver the program in whatever shape it looks like. And we've created a document called Delivering Federal Economic Recovery Program for the State of Minnesota. And in this document, we discussed the diverse project list that ultimately may come out of this. We discussed how to position ourselves to deliver, and we discuss how to be transparent and communicate the stimulus package. And we also identified many potential barriers that could come out of this, whether it be environment, right away, technical barriers. So I think we get a lot of questions about what this package might look like, but from my perspective, I think it's very important that we have the processes in place to deliver whatever's thrown at us, and that's what we're working very hard to do. John has been communicating daily with our external partners, the AGC, ACEC, and others, to make sure that we as a community can deliver these when it comes. Let me just close by saying that, I have a lot of hope for our future in transportation. We have a lot of challenges, and I talked about some of those here today, but I view those challenges as opportunities again, and I have a lot of hope for our future. And let me tell you why I think that. I think we've got a great spirit for transportation in our state. And I can tell you, having worked in many other states, that's not true everywhere. You can have a transportation meeting in another state, and you'll have two or three people show up. And we have such meetings in our state, the room will be packed. We always don't agree on things, but the fact that we're all at the table engaging in the discussion, I think, is the important thing. The second reason that I have hope is that we have great partnerships in our state, and you never want to overlook those partnerships. We have great partnerships with our counties and our cities. We have great partnerships with our private sector partners, the consultants, the contractors, and those are essential to move forward in a collaborative environment and to move forward in an environment of trust. And again, I can tell you that in a lot of states, that's not the case. So we've got a great foundation to build on. And lastly, I have a lot of hope because of the great workforce we have at MnDOT. We've got a great workforce at MnDOT. I knew that before I came here. I'm very proud of that. And that's not to say we do everything perfect. That's not to say we can't improve things. But we've got, a great foundation to build off from. And I wouldn't have taken this job if I didn't feel this way. I wouldn't have taken this job. if I didn't have that hope. And that's why I'm here. I want to help fulfill that mission and carry out the things that I talked about. So I thank you for giving me the time here, and that's all I really had.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. And before I go to the rest of the committee, I just want to say for your benefit and the people in the state of Minnesota that after August 1st of 07, there were a lot of wet eyes with a lot of the folks that are sitting there behind you, the employees of MnDOT, a lot of people around this table, and families all across the state and actually all across the country. Now, Senator Dibble and I have had the opportunity to go to several conferences and talk about some of the things that led up to August 1st and some of the changes that have been made after August 1st. And I firmly believe that your appointment was the impetus to change a lot of the things that we have seen in the department. And I think the governor made, I really believe that in your case, he made the best possible choice that he could make. I believe that you're one of the best commissioners that he's ever appointed. And so thanks to the governor, and you know, we've noticed the huge change within the department and the way that the department interacts with the legislature and with the public as well. And I say that from talking with city officials in Red Wing and Winona and Belle Plaine and all over the place, counties like Goodhue and you know, up there by up in Scoey's neck of the woods. Everybody has had a lot of positive things to say about MnDOT and the direction that you're going in. So whatever you're doing, keep doing it. And you know, this is it makes running this committee a lot easier to have folks that are right there, like you say, engaged and ready to get the work done. So, you know, to you and all the employees that have worked so hard here over the past year and a half, we really appreciate it. I know that Mr. Gutnick is here, and he had a lot to do with the 35W bridge. And Mr. Gutnick, thanks for the tours that you gave our members and for all the hard work and long hours that you put in. And you did a fantastic job every time the cameras and the lights were turned on you. So thank you, Colonel. With that, Commissioner, I have a couple questions. And first, you know, we had several issues last year that were in front of us that caused a lot of heartburn. One was the design-build project, or program, I should say. The legislature had a few ideas on how to make that better. And I believe that you and your staff have worked to make, I think it was like 10 items on the list. I think I threw out three of them because they probably didn't work very well. But I think the other ones you've either implemented or changed a little bit and implemented. And so if we could, you know, maybe hear just a little more about some of the changes to that program.
Sure. Thank you, Chairman. You're absolutely right. We have been taking a hard look at our design build program, and you know, I visited with many of the contractors myself, and I heard many of their concerns, and so we acknowledged that it was something we needed to take a look at. And so what we did is we formed a working partnership with the AGC. And I've got members of my staff working daily with those folks to try to make the appropriate revisions. And I think, I don't know where it stands at this point in time, but I do know that we took those, that basic framework that we had talked about at the last session, and we're working off from that framework. And I know there's been a lot of progress made. I know we've discussed some of those things, and we've come to some agreement and conclusion on some of those, and we continue to address others. And I'm pretty confident that we're going to iron this out so that we don't have that situation this year. So I feel pretty good about where we're at.
Right. And whenever you get that thoroughly vetted with all the appropriate parties, you know, just let us know. We'd really like to look at, you know, bill form, what the ideas are down on paper, and you know, we'll get that taken care of. I have two more questions, and then I think Senator Bonhoff has a question, and I know that that Senator Saltzman is wants to make a motion here. So my two questions are this. You touched briefly on life cycle analysis. Maybe you can enlighten the committee as to kind of what the reason is behind the federal equation, figuring, you know, between concrete and asphalt, and why one has a preferred discount and the other doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, Chairman. The federal guidelines on looking at pavement selection are basically grounded around looking at a life cycle analysis approach, and they have these guidelines that are out there. It's up to, really up to the state DOTs to take those guidelines and that guidance and develop your own approaches, and that's what we've done. The current process that we use are pretty much in line with the federal guidance for life cycle cost analysis, and what we're trying to do, as I mentioned earlier, is to recognize that our times are different now, when our prices are volatile in our industry, whether it's asphalt or concrete, and our materials industry. And we're trying to use this alternate bid approach so that contractors can bid in a way that makes sense for them. And then we perform this life cycle cost analysis to figure out, over the long term, over a 50-year period, what is the best approach from a maintenance look on those projects. And so we can bring that back and do a present worth analysis and then make a better judgment so that we're not making these technical judgments at a time when it doesn't make sense because of the market. And so this process, I believe, has a lot of hope, and it'll be pretty easy to implement. And I think in the end it's going to give a better balance and a better approach and give us the better solution to the issues I know you're concerned about, Senator.
Right, and that basic issue is pavement life. And we all know that if you're running big trucks over asphalt, it's not going to last as long as, you know, an asphalt overlay, say, as a concrete overlay. And, you know, where do we start, you know, seeing an even dollar for dollar?
Right.
So we look forward to more of those discussions. And I know that we had the discussion about the federal stimulus package, and if I recall right, with the changes of this life cycle analysis, it'll be more of a balance between concrete overlays and your you know, regular asphalt overlays. So the work will be distributed a little bit better. You know, I think everybody on the committee is aware that there's times when an asphalt overlay is perfectly, you know, it's the perfect answer. And then there's other times when you need something a little more hardy. So,
right.
And my last question has to do with economic development. I know that we're going to have and continue to have discussions about the federal stimulus package. But as far as economic development and trying to use some of that $40 million that we set aside and for two different areas of the state, where do you see using transportation as a driver of economic activity in the future?
Senator, that's a good question. And one of the things that I was trying to point out earlier, if you look at these investment priorities on here, the last category in there is very much related to economic development. And one of the things we recognize is the importance of transportation and economic development. And we wanted to look at it the way we make our investments, and we kind of wanted to flatten the hierarchy and put these investment priorities on an equal plane so that if you're in one part of the state, one of these investment priorities may be more important than if you're in another part of the state. So we have that economic development component now built into our investment priorities. We flatten that hierarchy. And that's not to say that preservation isn't still important. because it's very important. That's not to say safety isn't important, because it's very important. But we wanted to incorporate economic development as a component of our investment priorities. And the interchange program that you're talking about, we recognize that that could serve as a model for us in the future, and we're looking forward to trying to implement that in a way where it does stimulate economic development, and we're looking for other opportunities around the state to do that. And we recognize that that could serve as a pilot program concept for the future. So we're working in that vein.
Well, good, because I know that, you know, as I said earlier, Senator Dibble and myself, and actually, you know, several members of the committee have been to different functions that were, you know, more national in scope. And, you know, some of the things that we're doing here, like being more aggressive with design build and the interchange account and some of these other things that we've done, other states are, you know, they're, you're doing what? And really, how does that work? You know, so you send them the information, and then a couple months later you see that they're trying to do what we're doing. So anyway, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Sorrell, I had the opportunity to go to St. Louis with you. I'm a Midwest High-Speed Rail Commissioner, and I got to know you there, and so I echo Senator Murphy's comments that we are so fortunate to have you here in Minnesota. I just want to share something with your department, because as a high-speed rail commissioner, everybody had to go around and introduce themselves, and so when it was the commissioner's turn, he didn't get up and talk about himself. He talked about MnDOT, and he said that that MnDOT was healing after the 35W bridge and how painful that was for the department and for him, and that it was all he wanted to do was work together with MnDOT to heal and go forward. And, you know, there was hardly a dry eye in the room, and so I know that you're all here too, and that we appreciate what you've all gone through, very different even than what we've all gone through in our families. So thank you for representing Minnesota that way at that conference, and thank you to your team.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Senator Dibble and then Senator Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'll just pile on here and echo what Senator Bonoff and Senator Murphy have said. I want to commend you. The past months have been very fruitful, and we had a great pleasure working and speaking with you, and also to your staff. Even just in the last few days, as I've put in inquiries on various subjects, I've appreciated the timeliness of the response, the thoroughness of the response, the respectful tone, the positive engagement of the responses as I've advanced issues that are important to my constituents. And it's a very, very welcome change. And I think it harkens to a new time that we can look forward to in the coming years and months, working together, trying to solve problems for Minnesota, and trying to do those things like economic development and set priorities for our state. Had a couple of quick questions, if you'll indulge me, Mr. Chair. Maybe I'll just lump them together real quickly, and you can answer the ones you want and ignore the ones you don't, maybe. So I appreciate your mentioning the federal stimulus package. I'd be interested in that document. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's a public document, but I assume it is because you waved it around in public. There's a lot of interest, and we're all trying to figure out what is the stimulus package going to be. Is it going to have earmarks, not earmarks? How do we interact with our congressional delegation and others to influence its outcome? So I'm curious to know more about how you're engaging with not just AASHTO and those kinds of organizations, but with the executive, the chief executive of this state, as well as with our congressional delegation, to maybe influence what that might look like. Mm-hmm. So we have a more proactive stance on what might come to Minnesota. But that also kind of dovetails with the next big federal opportunity, which is, of course, the reauthorization bill, which will get underway very, very quickly. And, of course, we have the great honor and pleasure of Chairman Oberstar helping lead that effort. So I'm curious to know what MnDOT's engagement is on reauthorization, because, as we all know, it's not being called reauthorization. It's becoming called authorization. Right. Going to represent a whole new way of thinking about transportation more holistically, as you've touched on. And so to that end, One thing we struggled with in the aftermath of the bridge collapse as a legislature is, you know, what is our relationship vis-a-vis the agency? What is our role in oversight? What are the agency's measures of success, and how do you report those to the legislature, and how do we create, you know, better understand measures of success, and if we don't have the right ones in hand, how do we develop those so we have a more open line, more awareness of what MnDOT does, how it does it, and, sure. and how we measure and evaluate that success. So that's kind of the grand omnibus question.
Chairman, Senator, those are all good questions. Your last question about how we communicate our performance measures, I think that goes back to this idea of transparency. And we have a lot of measures internally, and quite frankly, we haven't done a good job communicating those to our external partners, whether it's be our pavement conditions, our bridge conditions, those things we traditionally collect. And so we've been looking very hard at ways other states have been doing this. Virginia has a very good dashboard model that I'm very well aware of. We're looking at that as a potential way to communicate these things better. Florida does the same thing. And so we recognize and acknowledge that we need to do a better job with that. And Mr. Hankel's staff is working very hard to do that. And I think that's a key to that. And I also think that we need to look at the right measures. And when you look at our strategic direction, you know, there may be other measures that are better fit at this point, quality of life measures. And we need to investigate those kinds of things beyond the traditional technical measures that we use. So that's I happen to I'll be very soon chairing an ASHTO committee on this subject. And it's not just an issue facing us, it's an issue facing us nationally. And what are the right measures? And I tend to think that as a nation, we have to start to integrate risk, measures of risk into our business, and then quality of life measures. And so those are things that we'll be looking at. As far as the other things that you mentioned, economic stimulus, we are working very closely with all of our partners. Again, the focus has been primarily on barriers and processes, making sure that we're all aligned properly. So when a stimulus package does come, that there are no barriers in our processes. And that's what I've been primarily concerned about, not only in our state but at the federal level as well, to make sure that we're all in line so that, you know, we have a great example of how we responded when the bridge collapsed. I mean, it was a phenomenal response. And John Chigolo looked at how we developed that response, and he incorporated some of those things that we did into the processes that we hope to use. Now, we can't do it alone. We can't implement these processes alone. We need partners. You're one of those partners, and so we're going to have to work with you and others to move these programs forward. And, you know, there may be some new things that we'll have to do from an innovative contracting standpoint, for instance. Maybe there's some new contracting mechanisms out there that will need your help to advance. Those are things we may have to come back to you with. There's different mechanisms out there. There's contract manager at risk mechanisms that may be very helpful. There's lump sum mechanisms that may be helpful to move these forward. So we'll need lots of help in doing these things, and we'll need your help as well.
Thank you, Commissioner. but I'm going to let Senator Jungbauer have the floor here for just a second. But you know, moving forward, we're more than willing, and this committee always has been, to work on those things that are going to move Minnesotans safely forward. We're, you know, we anticipate having a very, you know, it's going to be a tough year. I think everybody realizes that. But, you know, if we keep those communication lines wide open, we'll be able to make the appropriate changes on how we rate pavement, you know, through this life cycle analysis. And, you know, the issue of the contract engineers is still simmering below the, you know, it's still simmering. You know, our design build, the economic development portion of it, you know, our minority contractors and the status that goes there, and, you know, the rail improvement plan, all these things we've got coming forward. And, you know, so it's not all going to be bad is what I'm saying. We're going to have some very high points, but we're also going to have some very low points. But we're not going to be able to get it all done unless we're all working in the same direction. And with that, I'll let our lead Republican, Senator Jungbauer, have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask the committee's indulgence today. If you see me sitting back kind of funny here, I'm having some problems with my neck, so I got to keep trying to adjust that. I have them held together by titanium and sheetrock screws, so some days it just goes out and you can't get it comfortable, so you sit very weird. I really want to thank you because, you know, since I've been here, I think MnDOT has done a good job. We've had some of our bumps along the way, but what I'm really seeing is this communication issue that you're talking about. And to really compliment the team you have behind you, because you can't do it on your own, but what I've really seen since you've been here is that coming together more as a team when people are reporting and coming into my office and giving us the updates of what's going on, that communication is key. And even as recent as yesterday, I got hallway updates on what was going on. And it was an issue on the complete street study that's coming up, something that's very near and dear to my heart. So I think that's been probably one of the issues is that's really what we need as legislators is we want to know where the projects are, what's going on. But to be just have any of the MnDOT staff and personnel feel free to stop by our offices mm-hmm. or stop us in the hall and just give us those kind of updates. And for whatever reason, it might not have happened before. I'm just really glad and excited to see it happening now, and that's very key to me. Also, having been at many of the meetings for the 35W Bridge, just the way the community meetings and things were handled in a time of real struggle, there was some good strategic partnerships built there. It was a good team. I mean, we looked at those contracts up front, and there was a lot of questions, and I think those questions were answered along the way. We got a good product, and we got it excitingly fast. And, you know, having a couple of copies of the book that was put out on the bridge, that was another great communication tool to let the public and some of us really understand what went into that bridge and the amount of work that it actually took to accomplish something that fast. So I think we've learned a lot of things. I think we've learned some new communication tools, and I'm really excited to have you on board.
Thank you.
Senator Dave,
I got a comment. It's probably not quite so complimentary. I've been on this committee 18 years, I believe. I've never met the commissioner, so I don't think his communications are all that great in dealing with me, anyway. And maybe I'm pretty open to going any place to do anything for transportation. So it doesn't irritate me. I don't have a very big ego, so it doesn't bother me. But yet, when somebody tells me that they really like this communication thing, I look at it and I go, wow. As you all know, I've had a lot of major transportation bills in my 18 years here. And to have a commissioner come and, you know, take over and you know, be here for almost a year, and I know that there's a group of people here that didn't like our last commissioner, and I'm not defending that. But I'll just throw that out because I know mm-hmm. Senator Jungbauer here. I hope he wasn't speaking for me, and I wanted to make sure that he wasn't.
I know where you're coming from, Senator Day. You know, this is my 17th session as well. I sit on several other committees, and on those committees, I've never met the commissioner of those areas either. The one thing I can say in Commissioner Sorrell's behalf is that, you know, I bet you'll have a phone call waiting for you back at your office for a little meeting.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Could I ask him just a couple of more specific questions? I don't want to drag this out, but.
Well, we have an overview coming right mm-hmm. after this.
Wait till then?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's going to be a very brief overview.
Sure.
We'll have a few questions. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also have not had an opportunity to meet with the commissioner or his liaison, and that's a disappointment. There are significant transportation issues right now in my district. I'd like to introduce myself, Commissioner. I'm Julianne Ortman from Carver County, and I represent part of Scott County as well. And the previous administration did a fabulous job in developing 212 out in my area. And we're really proud of MnDOT for the work that they did in developing 212. We also have a significant issue right now, and that's the 41 River Crossing. I have to say that your goal of transparency is a very good one, but I hope that you mean what you say, because I have citizens in my district, city council members, county commissioners that are all very concerned about the decision that MnDOT made about the placement of that river crossing. And so I've asked our chair to follow up and ask for a hearing with the folks from my community to talk about how that decision was made. In your materials, you talk about defining transparency, doing business in ways that legislators, partners, and the public understand. And I want to convey to you now what I would have at an introductory meeting, which is the residents of my district don't understand how that decision was made. They don't understand what the goals were, and they don't understand the decision-making process for that. There will be people unhappy regardless of what that decision is, but we need to have a fair and open process so that they understand. And so that will be one of my priorities this year, and I hope to work with your office on that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Saltzman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And as one of the people on this committee who had concerns about the leadership within this department, I want to commend you for the dramatic change in the morale of your staff, because some of us were contacted by people basically concerned about the department and what felt like a very immediate change. And I think you brought that on. You are a tremendous servant leader. You bring out the best in people that I have seen. And if I need to contact you, I pick up the phone and call, as you have seen. This committee probably works more closely with this state agency than most other committees, because in other committees we appropriate to many different, and that's why I think it's so critical that there be such a close relationship between MnDOT and legislators. And again, I really commend you on that. So with that, I would like to move that this committee recommend to the full Senate that we consent to the appointment of Thomas K. Sorrell as the new Commissioner of Transportation, and I'm honored to make that motion today. As his senator, by the way.
Very good. Is there, before we take a vote, is there anybody that wants to testify either on behalf of the commissioner or not on behalf of the commissioner? Seeing none, any more discussion from the committee? Seeing none, on the Saltzman motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Let the record reflect that it was a unanimous decision. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
If Mr. Sahib Jim, if you want to come forward, and we normally don't applaud or anything, but we'll have some, whenever the department decides to invite me over to schlep ice cream again, we'll have another party. How's that? Connie, welcome to the committee. So what we're going to do, folks, we want to take about 5-10 minutes here and talk just briefly about kind of the direction that where we're headed here, and because we're going to have a lot of discussions. Once the federal stimulus package becomes more concrete, we're going to have these two gentlemen back over in front of us along with a lot of his fiscal staff, and then as we work through the budget process, they'll be back again. So we'll take a little bit of testimony, a couple questions, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you, Chairman. What we wanted to do just in these first few minutes, I wanted to talk a little bit about the organizational structure at MnDOT and where we are today, and then Mr. Sahib Jim will talk a little bit about some of the trends that we're experiencing in transportation in our state. And we'll do that fairly quickly, and as you mentioned, we're happy to come back at any point to discuss these things further. So The package that you have in your handouts, there's some slides in here. That's what we're going to work off from. If you can dig those out, we'll look at those.
Gee, if you like that.
Looking at the moving beyond the first slide, and by the way, this was dated January 2000. We took an old presentation and updated it here, so had a little mistake there. But I want to look at the organizational chart that you see there on the second slide and just say a few words about it. As Senator Salzman said, one of my leadership philosophy revolves around servant leadership, that we're here to serve others. And at the very top of this organizational chart is the citizens of Minnesota. And that's very deliberate. That recognizes and acknowledges the fact that we are here to serve the citizens of Minnesota. And so that's a mindset that I feel is very, very important to the organization, and that's why you see that there. As you move down the chart, you'll see the governor and the legislature acknowledge there. That acknowledges that we have key partners that we have to work with. As a department, we're not a standalone department. One of the first things that I did when I came in as commissioner is I felt it was important to reinstitute the position of chief engineer, and I did. I went back to the combined chief engineer deputy commissioner approach, and I appointed Connie, Mr. Sahibjim, as that person. And there are several reasons that I did that. I felt that the department needed a definitive engineering authority, and that would be the role of the chief engineer. And I also know that around the country that the chief engineer status has meaning from a national perspective, is important nationally, and it's important to our external partners here as well to recognize and acknowledge a chief engineer. Moving down, it's just some of the things, the key things that have changed since the last time you saw this. The box on the right that you see there, there are some positions with new people in it. Government Affairs is now Scott Peterson. Communications is Kevin Gutnick. We elevated the role of the chief financial officer in the department. We've always had one, but we felt it was important to bring that into the leadership arena and have a more prominent status in the organization from an accountability standpoint. So Kevin Gray is now recognized there as the chief financial officer. We established a chief counsel position. Again, we felt that an organization of 4,500 people needed a chief counsel position to help us guide policy decisions, to help us move in some of these innovative directions that we're trying to move in, whether it be innovative contracting, innovative financing, where we need legal guidance. So we established that position. The other unique position that we established, it's off to the box on the left from my name, it's the Transportation Ombudsman. And there's a handout in your package that explains what that role would be. But Deb Levina serves in that role as the ombudsman, and it was a move to provide additional access into the department, and the ombudsman handles issues and that our stakeholders, our external stakeholders may have, and provides access to me personally and to the department that previously maybe wasn't there. Moving down into the lower boxes, we previously had 5 divisions. We now have 6, and we established a policy, safety, and strategic initiatives division. And the purpose to do that was to elevate the role of safety in the department and to acknowledge that we needed a group in the department that served in a policy analysis role, and to acknowledge that we need to have a group to guide strategic initiatives and prompt innovation in the department. And a lot of this group is focused on innovation and how we can prompt innovation across the whole entire organization. So we have that unit. And then the last thing that I might mention about the organization, if you look under engineering services, there's a group there called Project Scope and Cost Management. That's a new group we established. It's an effort to get a better handle on our cost estimates. We already have a process we developed for cost estimating and scoping, and we want to make sure there's a consolidated effort in our department to move those forward and to use that as a transparency opportunity to communicate with you all in terms of where our scope is and where our estimates are. And so we created a unit that's focused on that. So that's the way the organization looks now. What you have in front of you, all these folks that you see have pretty much been in different positions in the department. They've just been shifted around into strategic positions so that these positions that are intended to be very strategic and to move the agency in the directions that I mentioned earlier. And I do want to say when we established this organization, it wasn't done in a silo. I looked at every organizational structure in this country and every state. I drew upon my experience in working in other states. I consulted with staff internally. I consulted with external partners. And this was the organization that made sense as we move forward and as we move forward in a servant leadership kind of way. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Sahib Jim, and he's going to walk you through some of the other things that we're working on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, I'm Connie Sahib Jim, the Deputy Commissioner, Chief Engineer. I'm honored to be working for the almost confirmed commissioner. When he asked me to do this, I couldn't believe it. I jumped on the occasion. I can do a lot more from where I'm at because I have a lot of plans. And again, my job is basically to carry his vision and make this department a better place for the next people, however long we are here. So, because this department obviously has been around for many, many years, a lot of good things have happened, and we're just a short period of time to make this a better place. The slide that I want to go to first is called Mission. It's the third one. It's the third slide. That basically tells you when MnDOT was created, you know, in 1976 at the state level through the state legislature. I won't go too much more about it because I know you have a short time. I'd like to go to the next map, to the next sheet where it has the map of Minnesota. We're divided into eight districts, and they're all different in their in their challenges with regard to the pavements and weather fluctuations affects the different conditions for the pavements at different times. Bridges, growth in population, businesses, farming, tourism. So they all have their own unique challenges, but they all work together very closely. Next slide gives you some information about the size of the system that we manage, MnDOT, the trunk highway system. As you can see, it's about 12,000 miles, and of that, about a third of it is in the metro area, close to 4,000. The rest is in greater Minnesota. And the same with the bridges, about a third of it are in the metro area. We also, as you know, we work on managing the activities with freight movement and enforcing safety and regulations and permits for trucks and barges, ports, and freight-related issues. And there's some numbers there that you can refer to later, the amount of tonnage that that our system pushes through. The other part is transit, and that is not to be confused with the metro transit. That, as you know, is the Met Council handles that, our sister agency. We mostly deal with the greater Minnesota, and there's 73 counties that we work with in helping designing and implementing services for them. The other part is our organization is the aviation portion, and that's administering the state and federal dollars for I think, there's 130-some municipal airports that we work with. The other part is the bicycle and pedestrian way. We see that as a portion of the system. We talked earlier about complete streets, and that is part of that. We have a division, an office for that, where we look at design of facilities for that whenever it's adjacent or on the trunk highway system. The next slide talks about our core functions. And that's the first two are kind of our bread and butter, I would call it. The system operations and maintenance, those are the guys, I'm proud of everybody, but those guys that are out there plowing snow, and same guys in the summertime fixing guardrails and patching potholes. Guys that work outside, I'm really proud of what they do. I think this year they've done a fantastic job in the month of December. As you know, they got hit pretty hard, and often seems like every day, every other day, they had to be out there, and they never got a break. But through advancement in technology and partnership with the locals, I think we're doing a good job with taking care of our road system. And it is all safety-driven, obviously. And they also, the same folks are our bridge workers. They do bridge inspections and roadway and all the other infrastructure. The freeway operation piece within mostly in the metro area, those guys are a big part of the keeping the roads safe and easy to travel through. The other part is the program delivery. That is basically planning, scoping, designing the right-of-way, more project-related. And this year we're going to have about, and we'll talk about this probably in the future, but we're going to have about $700 million worth of projects in 2009 that have been let or will be, and then the following year will be close to $1 billion, I think, that will be let in the fiscal year 10. I talked a little bit about the multimodal already, and then the other part I wanted to touch on is the local road and bridge system. That's the state aid, and most of you know about that, where they have their own dedicated funds, 29% for the counties, 9% for the cities, and we simply administer those dollars, and we enforce their own rules. They set their own rules, and we work with them in partnership. The next slide talks about trend in vehicle miles traveled. In Minnesota, you can see the green graph looks like a much flatter slope. It's the population growth. Then when you look at the red curve, it's vehicle miles traveled, which is a much faster growth there. It flattens out there after year 2004. And then what you don't see is after that. And if you go to the next slide, it's some national data. Just like ours, starting 2005 through 2007, it's pretty flat, and then it starts to drop, the vehicle miles traveled. And basically, less vehicle miles traveled means less consumption of gasoline and less license plates purchased and less motor vehicle sales tax and so on, which means less revenue. Now you wonder where all these, what happens to all these people? What are they doing? Where are they going? I'm thinking they're either, it's one of three things. Either they're probably this time of the, since over the past year, it's probably unemployment has a lot to do with it, maybe. Maybe people are eliminating unnecessary trips. And the other part is maybe they're changing their travel habits. And I think that's probably the biggest one. And that's the part I think we're way behind the Europeans, I think. And they started this many, many years ago when their gas prices got to $4 a gallon, changing their driving habits. So, yeah, this is going down. This means less revenue. But I think maybe there's a silver lining in the cloud, maybe, that there's more use in changing their driving behavior, more use in transit, and which is better for the environment overall. And so it also points to that, like we've talked about before, the gas tax that is discussed nationally, maybe eventually will have to be, as you hear nationally, you're talking about looking at mileage-based, the other user fees versus a gas tax, a way of raising revenues. So that's all I wanted to say about that. Basically, our VMTs are down 3%. The next slide just gives you a snapshot of our road system where the state trunk highway system is about 8% of the whole mileage-wise of the whole grid. And the VMT that it carries is close to 60%. And then you see the county state aid and the municipal state aid. You see the township system, there's about 40% of our system, but their traffic is much less. So anyway, that's some data for you to have. The next slide is one that the commissioner mentioned earlier that I'm very proud of. I think we as a state should be proud of. Basically, going back, that's our number of fatalities going back to 2003. We had a shift in philosophy. Minnesota was one of the lead. I think there was 10 or 11 states that were in the lead nationally that had three major changes. One was developing partnership, how we look at these solving accidents and fatalities. Partnerships, all including all the roads, 50% of our fatalities are on the local system. We sometimes forget about that. And having a proactive way and systematic way of looking at this. And that, if you look in the 2003 time frame where the white part ends, that's about when it started to drop. In 2003, we set a goal of 500, less than 500 fatalities. That was another major shift. We used to measure this. This measure used to be a rate, 1.2 people per so many miles. We changed that. It's a lot more personable because it's a very important piece when a person dies on our system, and it affects many people. So we are identifying it by people, actually. And it's so it's been going down. In 2006, we reached the goal that we had in 2008. You see it goes up from 494 to 510. The reason for that is there's about 19 very tragic fatalities in there that were related to the bridge collapse and the six down in the southeast Minnesota with the floods. And you have heard in the media that we are down to 440 this year, and this number could change a little bit as reports come in. And our goal is to meet by 2010 be below 400. The last slide I have is based, and I envision that we will be back to talk about our long-range plan, our state transportation plan. This is the method that we use to prioritize what we're going to build, basically. It starts out with our vision and what we, with going through statewide outreach, talking to the public, to different districts. And this is basically our policy framework and our performance measures that comes part of this document. And we develop a document that's the next blue one is from 11 to 12, 20 years. That's our long-range investment plan, and which will have a constraint and unmet, will also identify unmet needs. And then the next two are the more closer to the present, where we talk about a 10-year plan, 5 to 10 years. That's our HIP program, Highway Investment Plan, and then our actual program, the 4-year program, which has dollars identified to it, which the Federal Highway has to approve because there's federal funds in it. And in parallel with this, as you can see, we have our modal system plans, the state freight passenger rail plan we're working on, and the same with our state transit plan. Then eventually it'll all go to construction and ribbon cutting. With that, I know you're short in time. This was a really broad brush, and there's a lot to talk about. So I will.
Any questions from the committee? Well, thanks again, Mr. Siebgen and Commissioner Holt.
Go ahead.
Senator Dibble.
Oh. Well, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Chair. I just had, like I said from before, a couple of specific questions. I see that the vehicle miles traveled is dropping dramatically, which is interesting. It'll be interesting to really understand as we move into the future why that happens. I think the $4 a gallon gas is a big reason, obviously, and. But, if there are larger trends afoot that we need to be aware of, that would be, I think, really interesting information for the committee as we start developing policy priorities and really start to understand transportation, as a larger function of how we want to organize our lives, as a function of demography, as a function of our goals around economic development and climate issues and that sort of thing. So to that end, I hope we're also thinking about some of those measures, touching on our previous conversations and taking full advantage of the limited resources that we do have to get the most transportation with the best co-benefits that are available to us. Wondering how you'd respond to that. Secondly, specifically, an issue that's come up recently touches on the best use of resources. I was involved in the ramp management study with the TAD ramps. Now I think we call them the ABC ramps. Can you just, if you can give us an update on where we're at on that? I know that there's been a lot of work done to try to make the best use of that for all of its purposes that they were originally built for, parking, some of the mode queuing, and bringing the buses into downtown and some of that transition. Just kind of give us an update on where we are for that, adding to the vitality of downtown, another co-benefit. And then I'll just heap on my third question too. I spoke earlier with Tim Henkel about how we make best use of our transit dollars and get people around in communities who can't necessarily drive their cars. We've got a lot of opportunities there, and this ICTC group is doing a tremendous amount of work. Well, Jen Olson says we should do PRT. I don't know if we can do PRT in Greater Minnesota, but where are we with the interagency coordinated transportation planning, and what can we do to move those ideas forward in the coming year?
Mr. Chair, Senator, with regard to the ramps here, we've had a lot of interest in the ramps, and we had sent out an RFI a couple years out and see what kind of interest there would be, what type of things we could, and in our mind it was interest in ways that we could improve, just like you said, that it would help the 394 corridor and the whole transportation system. And we did get get some proposals in, such as golf domes and things like that, and we did not go through with that. So I don't know of any other activities, and I don't know if No, I think maybe we can follow up with
That's
you on
fine.
That if there's any more things to say about it.
And Mr. Chairman, if it's okay, Senator, the questions you raise or the comments that you raise about understanding where this people are going and is this a fundamental shift in how they maneuver about and their mobility options, I think that's a great point, and we need to understand that. And I don't know that we do right now. But we need to understand that and why this is why things are happening, and are there fundamental things happening here related to quality of life? I keep going back to that. It's a quality of life thing in its deepest sense. And I think we have to understand that, and I think we need to come back to you on that. And the other comment you mentioned about various services, transit services, I think, the governor is very interested in looking at shared service opportunities. And I think we have some of those staring us right in the face, and we've got to look at those kinds of options as shared service opportunities. I think it's very consistent and very much in line with what we're doing at creating an efficient government. So,
great. Well, I'm very excited about those ideas specifically,
sure.
So I stand ready to work with you on that this year.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Carlson, did you have a...
Yes, I have three totally unrelated questions. The first one is, and it's similar to what...
Unrelated to each other or unrelated to the...
Unrelated to each other, yes. the first one is the one that Senator Dibble somewhat related to, and that's in the vehicle miles traveled, and your slide on page 5 where it talks about the percent share of daily vehicle miles traveled. And if there's a... I would imagine you put a lot of thought into this and some study, and I'm looking at... how that's changing to get that reduction that you show in the previous slides, and how that maybe projects your vision for what we're going to do. And I guess what I'd just like to do is request that perhaps you share that with us in the future, how each one of those particular indexes are reducing or changing, increasing, because I would imagine some of them may be increasing and some of them may be decreasing. And I'm hoping that you can do that for us.
Yes, we will do that.
Senator Carlson, can you give all three questions to Mr. Siebjem, and then he'll, in writing, he'll respond to you, because we're going to be out of here in 30 minutes, and we've got probably one of the most important safety provisions on the agenda.
Sure. I'll be real quick okay. with The other one, well, the other one is really not a question. It's just a statement for both of these gentlemen that I'm very happy with what has happened here. I'm very happy with your service. And we need to be here, and I'm going to make a statement here that's a little bit coded, that I'm hoping that anyone that doesn't understand it comes to you and asks about it. And this is your efforts to maintain your professionalism in the department and also to attract and retain people. And I guess what I want to do is I want to thank Mr. Sebjam for taking this chief engineer position, and I'm just awed at the amazing and huge raise that you have accepted to take on this position. So if anyone doesn't understand that, they need to ask someone that's related to the department, and then you will be made to understand. And that's a situation that I think we need to repair.
Mm-hmm. What was it like? You got a $5 raise or something like that a year? Or was it a $5 reduction?
It's 2 cents per hour. I don't know how much that is.
Oh, okay. That's not a whole lot. So, well, anyway, Commissioner and Assistant Commissioner, thanks for being here. And we look forward to the discussions in the future. So thanks again.
Thank you.
Keep up
the
good work.
Members of the committee, we have Senator Murphy, who is going to present the Senate file that has not been introduced yet, and what this is the primary offense seatbelt legislation.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, can I just ask, is the intention to take a vote on this today? Because we do have session. I realize it's a brief session,
No.
Okay, because
no,
we don't have a Senate file or anything.
Right. Mr. Chairman, Senator Fischbach, what we're going to do is we're going to amend the bill and then put it on the table. Once it gets a Senate file number, then we'll take it up for a full vote in the committee on Tuesday. That'll be the first order of business on Tuesday. And, yes, according to our rules, we can amend the bill before it has a Senate file number.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, I guess, can someone explain that rule to me, that we can have a bill in front of us that doesn't have a Senate file number and amend it?
Ms. Berezovsky will explain it.
Mr. Chair, the bill and the amendment are just here for discussion but not for official action. Neither can be officially acted upon until introduction, but I think the intent is just to present both the bill and a technical amendment, and then the discussion will have been had when it comes up for vote after introduction.
All right. Right. Mr. Chair, thank you. That's what I was just curious if
right.
there's going to be. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fischbach, the official action is next Tuesday, and that's the vote on the final bill.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, what you plan on is discussing the amendment you were talking about. Okay.
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, if we could have that, I believe it's the A1 amendment just passed out. It's a technical amendment. We can take action at a later date if Senator Fischbach feels more comfortable that way, but it's strictly a technical amendment, but if we could address the bill like if that amendment has been adopted, that'd be great.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, you made a comment about me feeling more comfortable. I think that's just following the rules. It's not necessarily trying to make me comfortable, but we can't take action on a bill until it's been introduced.
Mr. Chairman,
I just wanted to make that clear.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Murphy, that's what our counsel just told us, is that we can't take action on it today. Senator.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, no. Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, we're not taking official action today. Okay? All right, good.
So what we're going to be doing is just we're doing an efficiency review here. So we're going to just bring everything up, but no action.
So it doesn't make any difference.
And we are, Senator Murphy, from what I understand, we're not going to move the amendment either.
No, it's just here for discussion.
Correct.
And when we take the final vote, the A1 is part of it. Mr. Chairman and members, now that we've got all those things out of the way, this bill is very simple to understand. It has a $25 surcharge to it. We've had this discussion in Senator Moy's office, committee several times about the outrageous costs of court costs and surcharges and different fees, and so we decided to lower this one down. This is the same bill as last year. $25 covers the court costs on even if there was multiple tickets written inside that car. The bill also states that everybody is buckled up all the time. Now, we are one of the few states that even though we don't have a primary seatbelt bill that did see a reduction in their death toll that was larger than the decrease in vehicle miles traveled. And I believe that has to do with a lot of different things, and one of them is a good enforcement and educational programs that are provided by the commissioner and the Department of Transportation, Department of Public Safety, and our State Patrol. With that, members, this bill once again this year is referred to as a Swanson Law in honor of Kathy Swanson, who spent the vast majority of her adult life trying to make highway safety a heightened expectation. The effective date, if you see in the bill, is the same effective date that we had last year, and that is to honor a young woman that had passed away due to not wearing a seatbelt, and her family, and that's the Cooper family. And I believe that Ms. Kathy Cooper is here with us today. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to the commissioner, Mr. Peterson, and we'll move right along.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Michael Campion is my name. I'm the Commissioner of Minnesota Department of Public Safety. And to Chairman Murphy, to the members of this committee, and to the Senate as a whole, I personally and professionally want to thank you for your continued support for traffic safety measures. Your legislation has, in fact, saved the lives of people that drive on the roads here in Minnesota. You have some handouts. You can look at it at your convenience. One of the handouts is a geographic map of each individual's area that you represent, and in that will show the number of fatalities that have died recently or in the past 2008 in the areas that you represent. Our structure today will be three different portions. We have a 15-minute video from the Minnesota State Patrol. I will provide some very short and brief comments, and then we have three people. I think there are four people are going to testify, one from the medical community, or two from the medical community, one from law enforcement, and also from a victim's perspective. I'm very proud of the Minnesota State Patrol for putting this on this video that you're about to see. It features four stories of tragic tragedies here in Minnesota. Everything that you will see on this video is real. I would suggest to you that it's very graphic. You're going to see bodies and body parts. This will give you a pretty good idea what the law enforcement community that you represent in your communities, that work in your communities that you represent, I should say, deal with on a regular basis. Some people might feel real uncomfortable about looking at this video. This video was not designed for you folks. It was not designed for adults. It was designed for a specific demographic that is overrepresented in fatalities and bad life-altering crashes here in our state of Minnesota. That is generally teenage drivers and drivers up through 20, 25, 29 years old, primarily males who think they're invincible, and the vast majority of them are in greater Minnesota. That's what this video is designed to impact. I would ask that you you envision yourself sitting next to your children who are about to drive, maybe sitting next to your grandchildren who are about to embark on their traffic driving world that it's all ahead of them. Envision through those eyes what is trying to be conveyed through this video. Our response so far has been overwhelmingly impactful and overwhelmingly positive. Parents are very enthusiastic about this video and have been very moved by it. And again, I ask you to look at it from a parent's perspective. Lieutenant? Mr. Chair, would you mind if people in the audience came over to this side of the hearing room just so they could see it?
Certainly. Certainly, yes.
I'd offer people to do that if they want to see it.
Last year in Minnesota, 52 high school students lost their lives, and over 5,700 were injured in traffic crashes. In fact, in the United States, traffic crashes are the number one cause of death among people between the ages of 3 and 21. Sadly, most of these traffic crashes are preventable. What you're about to see is graphic in detail. Everything is real, nothing is fake. It's reality. And the reality is people don't just die in traffic crashes. They're killed violently. If you don't take the job of driving seriously, the consequences can be tragic. The following video shows the results of traffic crashes in Minnesota caused by drivers who are not paying attention or who made poor decisions. It illustrates life and death and how the decisions you make impact not only yourself, but also those around you. Lives can change in a fraction of a second based on your choices. Please consider the messages.
Decided to go out to Hastings and along County Road 46. Decided to drive out there. I was driving a 2000 Lincoln LS, and I was driving, and I had too much to drink, obviously, and I guess the roads were a little icy. I don't really remember too much of what happened, but I guess the roads were icy, and I lost control of my car and went down the ditch and hit a culvert and launched my car into the air and hit a tree about 6 feet up of the tree and took the tree out, and the tree fell on top of my car and killed my friend that was in the car with me, and broke my back, my neck. Punctured a lung, lacerated my spleen and liver. I was knocked out for probably 3 days and I woke up in the hospital with a broken back. My mom came in and told me what had happened to my friend. She said, you weren't the only one in the car. And I didn't really remember who was with me, you know, so. And she told me that it was my friend Josh, and he was dead. I don't think people realize. I was just a really, like, to lose a really close friend. And especially, I mean, people are gonna die and everything, and that's not, but in this way, it's just a very violent way to die. It's not worth it. Don't drink and drive. Don't take the chance. You never know. You never know what could happen. You could make it home safely 1,000 times, but it's just that one time that can change your life forever. Just don't do it. It's not worth it.
She went off of the road and flipped into a tree. Brianna was not wearing a seatbelt, which caused her to fly out of the back window. Going out to see the car was probably the worst for me because I felt I could experience what she really went through. Just seeing all the dents in the car made me realize how much pain she could have been in, and I just broke down when I saw the car. It changed all of our lives by forcing me to grow up, and it changed my parents' life because now they worry about wherever I go and who I'm with, and I have to call my parents whenever I get to a certain place. Whenever I'm in the car with somebody and they're not wearing their seatbelt, I tell them they should. Whenever somebody's in my car, I make it a rule that they have to wear a seatbelt. It makes me feel good knowing that what happened to us has helped others not make the same mistake as my sister did. I want kids to take away from this that drinking and driving is very bad and it can ruin many lives, and not wearing a seatbelt and texting while you are driving can be very dangerous. It makes me sad knowing that I'll never get to hang out with my sister and go shopping with her yet.
Sunny days seem to hurt the most. Wear the pain like a heavy coat. I feel you everywhere I go. I see your smile, I see your face. I hear you laughing in the rain. I still can't believe you're gone. It ain't fair you die too young, like a story that hadn't just begun. But death tore the pages all away. God knows how I miss you, all the hell that I've been through. Just know no one can take your place.
Sometimes I wonder who you'd be today.
Didn't make it home. I went around the corner, and I can't remember too much about it, but it's a 90-degree corner, and I just went straight and hit the big tree. I don't remember anybody telling me that they were dead. It was just that my hospital room door opened up, and everybody just came into my room, and everybody was crying, and I don't remember anybody telling me specifically that they were dead. I think I already knew. It was so hard for me to see all those pictures of them. It was, like I said, I can't really tell my emotions. I don't know how to do it, but I mean, guilt, sad. I was so sad. I mean, I don't think I've ever cried that much. It was insane to see, like you said, the hope and the dreams that they had for them. It's like, what could they have been? Doctors, lawyers, you know, multimillionaires, like, what could they have been? And no one will ever know, because their life got taken. I was placed in jail for 2 years at the Rams County Workhouse. I'm on 23 years of probation. I don't have a driver's license until 2016. I have to pay $8,000 of restitution. I have probably $1,000 worth of court fees, $900 worth of probation fees. I have my lawyer fees. I have to pay my dad back my $10,000 in my bail. Wearing a seatbelt would definitely make a difference in their lives. They would have been alive, I'm sure. When you're gone, the pieces of my heart are missing you. When you're gone, the face I came to know is missing too. When you're gone, the words I need to hear to always get me through a day and make it with my sister and her friend driving home from a movie at 9 in the evening. My car slid into the path of an oncoming truck who T-boned me, critically injuring all three of us. And originally, the paramedics thought that they'd only be able to keep us alive long enough to donate my organs, because I wasn't going to make it, because my skull, eye socket, cheek, and jaw were severely crushed. It really hit me when I got home and I walked upstairs, and the bedroom right next to my bedroom was my sister's bedroom, and it was empty. And that was really the killer. My skull is now put together with titanium. My left side is not as strong as my right side, and I've had to work very hard through physical therapy sessions to re-strengthen it. My left eye does not blink, and being hit on the right side, nerves were injured on my left side. So my left eye doesn't blink, and it doesn't look up or down, and actually, I can't smell. For Angie and I, because we were wearing seatbelts, we're alive today. And they had to cut us out of the seatbelts to get us out, which is a good thing to know that we would be dead right now if it had not been for the seatbelts we were wearing. I think a lot of kids today don't wear seatbelts because it's not as cool, or you're relying on something other than yourself for safety. And it's kind of a pride issue. And kids need to realize it's not about being cool or being tough. It's about your life. Before, I thought, you know, car accidents happen to people who drink and drive, people who are messing with MP3 players or CD players, fiddling with the radio, with five kids bouncing around in the back, and thought, that's not going to happen to me because I'm a good driver. But car crashes can happen to anyone. My hope is that you may be able to see this and see that I'm just like any of you guys. And you could be driving home any day and slide, or have someone slide into your lane. And do what you can and prevent that from happening, because it's not worth your life.
Troopers and law enforcement officers are saving lives every day on Minnesota's roadways. By obeying these four simple rules, you too can save a life. Pay attention. Driver inattention or distraction is the leading cause of crashes in Minnesota. Drive the speed limit. Illegal or unsafe speed is the second leading cause of crashes in our state. Additionally, when the weather is bad, snow, ice, or rain, drive according to the conditions. Never drink and drive. Drinking and driving can account for one-third of all fatal crashes. Fourth, when you're in your car, wear your seatbelt. By using these four simple rules, you too can save a life.
It's not my time, I'm not good. There's a fear of me, it's not sure. This could be the end of me, everything I love. But it's not my time.
Mr. Chair and members, we have challenged the Colonel of the State Patrol to see if we can't have every kid in high school in the state of Minnesota see that in the next several months. Every death in this video that had to do with the seatbelts was preventable. These are needless tragedies. When we come over here to talk about fatalities on highways and seatbelt usage, we're not talking about stale, mundane, bureaucratic statistics. We're talking about people that have been shown on this video. We'll never prevent car crashes. We can never do that. But what we can do is prevent and mitigate or reduce the number of fatalities and life-altering crashes. We do know what works. In 2008, in Minnesota, we had the lowest traffic fatality rate since 1944. Now, granted, gas prices have something to do with that, less miles driven. But the fact of the matter is education, enforcement, safer highways, safer vehicles, enhanced medical response all contribute to that lowering traffic rate. With that, I'll introduce the next speaker. I'll ask Chief John Harrington to come up, and I will have some very quick comments at the end. We will be very concise and to the point, Mr. Chair and members. We'll try to get you out of here as soon as we can.
Thank you, Commissioner. Chief Harrington, please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Harrington, Chief of Police of the City of St. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Harrington.
Thank you. I became passionate about the idea of primary seatbelt back before I became chief, when I was the chair for the state national organization of black law enforcement executives group for the state of Minnesota. It was a major item on the agenda of NOBLE, the black law enforcement chief's organization, to move primary seatbelt ahead. And the reason that they stated was that minority wearing of seatbelts was at historic lows back in the 90s, and that in particular, minority use of seatbelts with their children were at a number that just shocked me. They were literally only 42% of minorities were buckling their kids in. Those were a lot of numbers, but as a cop, I've been to literally thousands of crashes over my career. And I can tell you that the most horrific crashes, the most devastation that you see, are in those cases where seatbelts were not used. Just in my short term as chief, I can tell you probably two of my most vivid memories, two of my worst days. Right after I became chief, over on the east side, 3rd and White Bear Avenue, one of my squads was out looking for a stolen car. We lost the car in the neighborhood, and then, boom, we hear a call for a crash on White Bear Avenue. A young man with his two kids had been blindsided by a stolen car that cut across White Bear Avenue at about 50 miles an hour. It T-boned the van, and the van was up in somebody's yard. But what was horrible was getting out of the car to walk up the street and to see one child, 50 feet down from where the van was. Another 10 feet down, the second child laying in the street. Now, we got lucky on that particular day. While neither of those children were buckled in, neither of them died. But I can tell you that from my experience, that was luck, and it's not something that you can count on. Unbelted motorists don't just hurt themselves. They hurt the people that are in their cars. They pull law enforcement from other duties that we could do. The city of St. Paul, in the last 2 years, we've responded to 22,000 motor vehicle accidents. A huge number of injuries in those accidents. Despite all kinds of devices with, you know, airbags and things along that lines, the speed with which cars are traveling, the way cars are constructed, when they come into contact, people bleed and people die. It pulls my officers out of other duties that could be incumbent on us, but as I said, what really troubles me is the lack of seatbelt usage. Now, when states have enacted seatbelt legislation in the past, what we've seen is two things happen, and I've noted this not just locally but every place else. Two things really do happen. Number one, primary seatbelt does cause people to buckle up. Maybe it shouldn't be that way. Maybe the ad campaigns, and I can tell you the Department of Public Safety has done some really phenomenal work in terms of public education, but I really think people unfortunately need both a carrot and a stick. And while the public information stuff is a great carrot, I think there is nothing like a hefty fine sometimes to get people's attention and to cause them to change their behavior, because that's what we need to do. In many studies, there was a lot of concern about whether or not primary seatbelt was going to increase racial profiling, and I can tell you that all the statistics from Michigan, Louisiana, Georgia, Oklahoma, Missouri, all contradict that. When you put primary seatbelt into place, you get higher levels of compliance in minority communities, but you get less ticketing of minorities. And so it actually has the reverse effect. Primary seatbelt does make minorities safer, and it does, in fact, reduce random or racial profiling. I would tell you personally that I feel so passionate about this that in the last year, we went out and went to the private sector and raised money for our own seatbelt awareness campaign. We have been teaching young moms and dads how to put car seats in and how to buckle their kids in, because I think it's just that important that we need to do this. And so we've gone out on our own to try and find the carrot. But I really do believe that primary seatbelt enforcement in this law is the stick that will bring us the rest of the way. We need to have this law. It needs to be a simple law. We need a law that is very straightforward, so that no matter where you are as a cop in the state of Minnesota, you see somebody, and I literally, it's not a day goes by, I don't look over and somebody's kid's bouncing across the back seat. I can look over and see the kid who's not buckled in. You need to have this law, and I really do strongly support its passage.
Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Chief.
Thank you very much. Dr. David Milbrandt.
Thank you, Dr. Milbrandt. Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Dave Milbrandt. I'm an emergency medicine. Actually, I'm the director of the emergency department at Fairview Lakes Regional Medical Center up in Wyoming, Minnesota, and also the medical director of several ambulance and first responder groups in the North Metro. I'm testifying here on behalf of the American College of Emergency Physicians, the Minnesota chapter. I'm a board member there, and I served as a counselor to the National ASEP meeting this past October in Chicago. ASEP has a long-standing policy supporting making failure to wear a seatbelt a primary offense for the simple reason that upgrading the seatbelt law will increase seatbelt use and therefore will increase life savage. I can tell you that the Minnesota Medical Association, who represents 11,000 physicians, residents, and medical students, also supports this legislation. According to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, wearing a seatbelt reduces the risk of death and serious injury by at least 50%. Passing this legislation is one of the most efficient and cost-effective ways to increase seatbelt use in Minnesota. The Minnesota Department of Public Safety has found that traffic deaths is the main cause of death in people age 4 to 44. And it's actually the leading cause of death in pediatric patients, and it surpasses all other pediatric illnesses combined. The impact of a 35-mile-an-hour motor vehicle accident is roughly the same as falling out of a three-story building. Usually we're not driving at 35, we're driving faster than that, and so the resultant injury can be more severe. Properly wearing a seatbelt reduces the risk of fatal injury in trucks by 60% and in cars by 45%. Rollover accidents are infrequent, relatively infrequent, but they do cause 32% of all occupant fatalities. And seatbelts are 74% effective in preventing death in cars. So I'm throwing a lot of numbers out there. You know, you guys can all read this stuff. And I've worked in an ER for 18 years. And, I mean, the rollover motor vehicle accidents, some of which we saw in the video, what happens with those? They're usually not you just kind of roll down into the ditch and kind of tip over on the side. It's usually you lose control of your vehicle, starts turning sideways. The center of gravity forces the vehicle to just tumble. That first tumble, what happens is all the windows break. The next thing that happens is you either get ejected from the vehicle, or if you're not that lucky, you get partially ejected from that vehicle and the vehicle rolls on you. The ejection injuries, you're going to get, you know, death, traumatic brain injuries, spine injuries resulting in paralysis. You know, you're thrown anywhere from a few feet to many yards from the vehicle. I'm continually amazed at how well people do in rollover accidents that they're wearing seatbelts. It's the difference. I see it every day. You get into less speeds. I had a guy on Tuesday that came in, motor vehicle accident, 30 miles an hour, front end impact. He wasn't wearing a seatbelt, so his head hit the windshield, came in by ambulance with a head injury and a laceration and neck pain, and you know, ended up getting a CT scan of his head and neck and laceration repair. He ended up doing okay, but the point I want to make is if he was wearing a seatbelt at 30 miles an hour, may have had a whiplash injury, maybe got a neck x-ray and gone home not had any sort of debilitation. This bill has the potential to save even more than adult lives. They found that if a driver is wearing their seatbelt, the children passengers are more likely, 87% a chance to be strapped in as well. That number goes down to 24% if the driver's not wearing a seatbelt. You'll hear more about the long-term costs as a result of injuries sustained from auto accidents when a victim is not wearing a seatbelt. I can tell you that in the emergency department, that cost starts immediately. If someone's unbelted, it raises the mechanism of injury is more severe. It raises our suspicion of injury. We're going to order more tests. We're going to take up more time. And in the greater Minnesota hospitals, that a lot of which are covered by one ER doc, one nurse, one X-ray tech, you get a family of four in a car accident, and that's going to really take up all the resources that they have in that hospital. And, you know, you've got to take care of the chest pains and the abdominal pains and everything else that's coming in as well. Wearing a seatbelt is good preventive medicine. Crash victims who are not wearing seatbelts do have more serious injury and consequently much higher medical bills. Legislation will not only prevent serious injury and death, but it will help reduce health care costs by keeping people out of the emergency departments. I'd like to say that not wearing seatbelts is good for business, but it's honestly a business that I don't want to have. So, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Milbrad. Commissioner Campion.
Michael Sandman.
And Dr. Milbrad, if you have not, please be sure to sign the log also. And any witnesses, please be sure to sign the log.
Thanks for having me.
Mr. Chair.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Mike Sandman. I'm a physical therapist, and I am happy to have the opportunity here to talk about seatbelts and spinal cord injury today. I'm a physical therapist working at Bethesda Hospital, It's about three blocks from here, and we rehabilitate people who have had some of the most serious spinal cord and brain injuries in all of Minnesota. I'm here on the behalf of the Minnesota chapter of the American Physical Therapy Association, and I'd like to talk about the impact of seatbelt use on the life-altering impact of spinal cord injuries on the people of Minnesota. I'm talking about the survivors today. We've seen a lot of pictures of people who don't survive the accidents because they're wearing their seatbelts. When I was a kid, people used to say, well, I'm not going to wear my seatbelt. I'd rather be dead. Well, that's not a choice. Motor vehicle accidents are the leading cause of spinal cord injuries, 50% nationally, and Minnesota rings true with that. In Minnesota, of those spinal cord injuries, half of which come from motor vehicle accidents, 64% of our non-fatal spinal cord injuries are people not wearing their seatbelt. The statistics on traumatic brain injury, which is even more frequent than spinal cord injury, is 60% of our traumatic brain injury survivors in auto accidents were unbelted. National Spinal Cord Injury Statistical Center estimates that the lifetime cause of high tetraplegia, you might be familiar with the term quadriplegia, it's the same thing. It's the type of patients that I see at my hospital. Lifetime health care costs are about $2.25 million. That doesn't take into account the cost to the family for lost income, for changed lives. On a more personal level, these statistics are reflected in the patients we treat just three blocks from here. They're generally young men with complete or partial paralysis. They're breathing with a ventilator. About half of them have been involved in motor vehicle accidents, and reflecting our national trends, more than half of them were not wearing their seatbelts when they were in the accident. The relationship between safety belts and spinal cord injury is evidenced in the research on spinal cord injury. Use of the lap belt and shoulder belts decreases the incidence of severity in auto accidents. Pennsylvania study showed that people wearing seat belts are 2.4 times less likely to have a spinal cord injury than occupants who are not wearing their seatbelts. The Midwest Regional Spinal Cord Injury Center in Chicago reports a 22-year study of 1,300-plus patients admitted with spinal cord injuries after motor vehicle accidents. They found less severe spinal cord injuries with belts. One of the things that was a limitation of this study is only 14% of their sample of spinal cord injury was wearing a seatbelt. It was hard to even do statistics on those people's injury because there weren't enough of them. I think I'm just going to move on with my statement to say that the things that we see in our hospital are consistent with the national data. Our patients with severe spinal cord injury report non-use of safety belts at the time of the accident. I'm convinced that these, not deaths, but these life-altering injuries would be significantly decreased and significantly change the lives of patients and families in our state with spinal cord injury.
Thank you, Mr. Sandman.
Carol Buffton.
Courtney Four and Malika Bonner.
Thank you very much for coming to the committee. Please identify yourselves for the record and then continue with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, I'm Malika Bonner. I'm a senior at the High School for Recording Arts, and I'm here representing the Click for Life campaign, where we go around and we raise awareness for wearing your seatbelt. I'm here to just really stress the fact that this is a matter of life and death. Our young adults and teens, they're dying, you know, from not wearing seatbelts. These things can be prevented with seatbelts. We, like he said before, we can't prevent car crashes. However, we can prevent what happens, you know. And so, excuse me, I am a little nervous. As I said before, it's the leading cause of death in teens and young adults. And also, it's the leading injury death for Minnesotans. As Chief Police said before, I understand why a lot of you may believe that there will be racial profiling. But coming from a high school where we are, you know, the majority as African Americans, we are the majority there. And just to be real, if police are going to profile you, they're going to use any reason, not just the seatbelt law, you know. And if they do profile me, at least they can't come over and, you know, give me a citation, you know, for not wearing my seatbelt. So I'd rather be not guilty in that case, you know. They pull me over, okay, it's a little bit of time out of my day. However, I was wearing my seatbelt. I wasn't ticketed. I'll be fine. Also, as you said before, there were many states in the past that have passed the law, and there was a decrease in citations. There were decreases in traffic stops, and African Americans, who were the ones to least likely wear their seatbelts, had a very significant increase in wearing their seatbelts. I was at an event last night, and many of the legislators were there, and the governor was there, and the topic of interest was balancing the budget for Minnesota. Well, I was reading up in 2001 through 2005, there was about 1,242 fatalities and 3,200 injuries due to not wearing your seatbelt or car crashes. If we could have had those, if those people would have been wearing their seatbelts, we could have saved approximately 1.1 million per person. And I did that in some calculations in class today. And that was for the fatalities. And for the injuries, we could have saved $52,000 per person. So I just can't stress enough how much this is a life and death matter. So racial profiling might be a small issue, but as I said before, they're going to profile you regardless, you know, if that's really the case. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record and then continue with your testimony.
Okay. My name is Courtney Ford. I attend high school for recording arts, and I'm also a part of the Click for Life campaign. Where our main goal this year is to get the primary seatbelt law passed. As you all know, car crashes is the number one cause of death among young people, but it's highest among people ages 15 to 24. Not only is this something that we're just doing because it's a part of school, it's something that we're doing because we care. It really is affecting our peers. People are dying. There was a guy who got into a car accident in our school, and he wasn't wearing his seatbelt. He was ejected from the car. Luckily, he lived. He had a broken leg. He had a seizure at the scene, but he's still alive, and that was pure luck. So these are things that are happening every day around us, and it's an issue. It's not only an issue for us. It's a safety issue. It's a public safety issue. It also costs taxpayers money, lots of money. Not only will getting this law passed save money, but it will save lives. A lot of legislators say that people should have the right to choose if they want to wear their seatbelt or not. In my opinion, it's just like directly not common sense not to wear your seatbelt before you get in a car. It does have an effect on us. We are the people that this will affect in the future. Your kids, your grandkids. This is something that will affect them in the future. And like Malika said earlier, studies show that racial profiling is not an issue when it comes to primary seatbelt law. In Wisconsin, they passed the primary seatbelt law, and there was no increase in racial profiling. So I've been a part of the Click for Life campaign for about 2 years, and we've been raising awareness, going around the schools, getting teens to pretty much realize that wearing your seatbelts are cool is cool. So that's pretty much it. And by passing this law, it's not a guarantee that you will live if you get into a car accident and you are wearing your seatbelt. But it does greatly reduce the chance of dying in a car accident. So this is something that we want to stress when trying to get this law passed. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, I have 60 seconds and I'm done.
Mr. Capia.
I have a great deal of respect for legislators and the decisions that they have to make. Oftentimes you will have a piece of legislation in front of you that you know is a good piece of legislation you can all agree on, but it costs too much money. In other words, you take money from here and you have to put it here. Those are the very difficult decisions you make. I would suggest and offer to you that this is one of the most impactful pieces of legislation, frankly, that you can vote on. And here's why. And these statistics are, there's empirical data to back this up, and you've heard some of it already. We'll save at least 30 lives in the state of Minnesota in the course of a year. About 400 life-altering crashes will be prevented as a result of primary seatbelt. We will reduce medical costs, estimated the first year, of about $25 million. The latest poll, two-thirds of Minnesotans believe that it should be a primary offense. And 87% of the driving public already complies with the primary seatbelt law. For the same reasons that you voted for graduated driver's license, that being a piece of legislation focused on the most vulnerable and overrepresented people in car crashes and fatalities, should be the same reason that primary seatbelt should be appealing. Primary seatbelt's not for you and I, not the people in this room. I mean, 98% of people buckle up. You saw the videotape and who is overly represented in fatalities and car crashes. And the fact of the matter is, Mr. Chair and legislators, it won't cost you any money. There's no fiscal note to this piece of legislation. That's what you get, and it doesn't cost the taxpayers of Minnesota any money. And additionally, there's $3.4 million in federal incentive money if, in fact, the state of Minnesota passes a primary seatbelt. It can be used for traffic safety-related construction costs and to change people's driving behavior. So with that, I appreciate your patience and your willingness to listen.
Thank you, Mr. Campion. Senator Murphy, how would you wish to proceed?
Mr. Chairman, we do have the Senate file now. Yeah. With the Senate file, I believe it's 43. And
42.
It's 42, it's in front of us. But, I did make the commitment earlier on that we would vote on this first thing on Tuesday, and I'd like to do that. The one thing that I can say to kind of piggyback on the commissioner's last statement there, and these are the numbers that I heard at the last conference I was at from AAA, that 6% of our drivers are teenagers, but they represent 12% of all the fatalities, and that is the group that we're trying to get at. We're trying to change those behaviors early on so that we have a good, safe driving public. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members.
I think without any further ado, we will adjourn for the day. Committee meeting's adjourned.
That's going to work for the meeting.